You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Howard Bryant, senior writer, ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, author of Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Also on the program today, Corona testing hits a roadblock and Operation Deflect in full effect. Trump suspends funding to the World Health Organization because who needs them during a pandemic? And it was low-hanging fruit, but I will pat myself on the back anyways. Donald Trump insists on having his signature on the stimulus checks, slowing their release. And also, he's not even signing them. The treasurer signs them. He's just putting his signature in the memo. And speaking of those checks, apparently, Congress felt it was okay for your bank to seize them to pay your debts. Sort of misses the point. Meanwhile, it's announced that Elizabeth Warren will be endorsing Biden today, the last primary contender, really, to do so. Sort of a weird plan, as these goes. It's going to cost way more than Medicare for All, as health insurance companies need a bailout, say health insurance companies. And as New York City passes 10,000 coronavirus deaths, it received 12,000 per virus case in aid versus some red states, including Nebraska, which got 380,000 per case. Amazon fires more workers involved in workplace organizing. And lastly, Susan Collins chides Donald Trump for, quote, very uneven performance on coronavirus. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, we will always have Susan Collins to be there for us. Really chided Trump. I mean, just completely chafed this guy. All right, I'm getting distracted. I've got like a, for some reason, I landed on a Cardi B video on Twitter where she's eating a mango, and it's distracting. Need to get that out of there. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Special show today. This interview I did with Howard Bryant. I did, and honestly, like it was back in the studio, so it must have been the first week or second week of March. And we have about four or five of these, and we were saving them for this week, which was going to be our vacation week. We're obviously not taking vacation. For myriad of reasons, but this was a great interview. We would have used it earlier, but with all the insanity that has been going on, we have this one. We have about four others, I think, three or four other interviews that we will be sprinkling in over the next couple of weeks. Hopefully, today will be a shorter show as. We do want to take a I guess, an abbreviated vacation, like a half a day, not even a half a day. So we will have this interview with Howard Bryant. I know you'll enjoy it. I want to do plugs and notices today. Don't have too many of them, but wanted to let you know about them. This is, you can send your plugs and notices to majorityreporters@gmail.com. majorityreporters@gmail.com, and put plugs and notices in the subject line, and I will read them for you, for everyone's purposes. And if you want to go back and look, you know, we have stuff on how to make masks in this. We have links on how to donate stuff to people, mutual aid initiatives. You can just Google plugs and notices and Sam Cedar YouTube, and you will find, you should be able to find all of them. Maybe we have them in a playlist. That might be a good idea to do. Meanwhile, here they are. We have UPS workers are organizing to protect themselves from COVID-19, and they need your help. Your donation today can save the lives and protect workers in their communities. You can check them out. The Teamsters are trying to help them organize. We have a couple of links to a GoFundMe and one to TDU.org, making UPS deliver supplies. So check that out. Also, we got a call a couple of weeks ago, and this is from these guys. And one of them was asking my advice about a talk show on terrestrial radio. They're on a conservative talk station. They were planning to broadcast the first Saturday in April, but they had to punt to the first Saturday in May because the station wanted to minimize unnecessary traffic, and the other hosts are working from home. They don't have the ability to do that. They don't have the equipment. And a couple of advertisers pulled out, hampering their ability to pay for the airtime. And so you can help these guys out. It's patreon.com/TheValleyLaborReport, or you can get in touch with them at Labor Reporters on Twitter, and you can advertise on their show. The rates seem pretty reasonable to me. And, you know, they're trying to do a terrestrial radio show in the heart of a conservative station and a conservative town. So help them out. Also, for anyone in the Midwest, writes Thomas in Minneapolis, for people looking for a good cause to donate during the pandemic, Redeemer Center for Life in Minneapolis is collecting donations for an emergency rent fund. They serve folks in need in North Minneapolis. You can find it at redeemercenter.org/donate. You can look for this on YouTube. We will put all the descriptions, all the links in our description of the podcast and on YouTube. You can check those out as well as we go forward. None of these headlines are terribly intricate. I will say this, the story about your checks. There's a couple of angles to this whole check thing that's happening. As you know, if you have an electronic account already, and most people do not with the IRS, unless maybe you're a small business person or something to that effect, your check is going to have to come by mail. In some instances, this could take months because the government only has the physical capacity to print 20 million checks per week. So you do the math. I don't know. Let's just assume 80 million people have direct deposit from the IRS. I don't even know if that's the case, but you're still talking maybe a couple hundred million people who might be eligible for these checks. And it could, you do the math. You know, we could be talking about 10 weeks. In some instances longer. The checks apparently have been held up. Why? Because Donald Trump must have seen the check and been like, where's my signature? I got to have my name on the check. I'm paying Americans, and I got to have my name on the check. But the complication is, well, A, that they had already printed some, and they were about to send them out. So those are going to be delayed. The other complication is that Donald Trump, the president, doesn't sign checks from the Treasury. the treasurer. It will be the first time a president's name appears on an IRS disbursement, whether a routine refund or one of the handful of checks the government has issued taxpayers in recent decades, either to stimulate a down economy or share the dividends of a strong one. George Bush sent out a bunch of checks. Trump apparently had privately suggested to Steve Mnuchin, who oversees the IRS, to allow the president to formally sign the checks. This is according to three administration officials who spoke on a condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. The checks will carry the signature of an official with the Bureau of Fiscal Service, the Treasury Department division that prints the checks. But his name and his signature, President Donald J. Trump, will appear on the memo line. Now, I did predict that he would do this over 6 weeks ago. I think it was. We were back in the studio at that time. But like I say, low-hanging fruit. But also, I could use a pat on the back. And so I will take that. According to the Washington Post, when people get these checks, they're more often than not just going and spending it on food. Because we already know the statistics of the vast, a huge number of Americans, maybe over the majority of Americans, didn't even have $400 saved up. And with now, I mean, who knows how many millions of people have lost their jobs? I would imagine we're close to about 20 million at this point. People are hurting. And this is it's going to get more difficult, folks. Meanwhile, David Dayen has a big scoop over at the American Prospect, and I interviewed him for Ring of Fire Radio. You can check that out. That will be released over the weekend. You can check that out on Stitcher or iTunes or wherever it is. Regulators have given the banks green lights to use the stimulus funds to pay off debts that individuals owe them. So in other words, if you owe your bank, let's say, money on a loan, maybe you have a credit card issued with them. If you do get rid of those direct deposits, they can take the check. Apparently, Dan and the Prospect got hold of audio of the Treasury Department having a webinar with banking officials last week. Rhonda Kent, Chief Disbursing Officer with the Treasury's Bureau of Fiscal Service, can be heard explaining that banks had posed questions to her about whether these payments could be subject to collection from the bank to which the money is deposited if the payee owes an outstanding loan or other payments to the bank. And she responded twice, so there was no mistake, that there's nothing in the law that precludes that action, while counseling that the bank's compliance officers should consult with their legal officers about what policies their banks will implement. You will want to know for your bank what your bank has decided to do. In other words, it's up to you guys. Have at it. You want to take their money? It's only $1,200. They only need it for food. I wouldn't worry about it. That's what the message is. I mean, this is... the screwing, the massive screwing that the American public is basically teed up for, I think is going to be really impressive. Impressive in a bad way. I've got a couple of ads here, I just want to, reiterate that it's your support that is keeping this program going. We're still getting some ads. We have lost a lot of ads, like a lot of shows. In fact, I would imagine almost all shows on YouTube. I mean, we're watching media entities lay off people. The LA Times mentioned, announced yesterday that they were going to be laying off and furloughing people. The problem is ad rates, ad buys essentially are drying up. And, it's only going to get worse from here in. So, for members, we're contemplating maybe keeping ads in occasionally. I mean, I'd like to hear from members as to whether you are interested in that. Only because, you know, these are deals. These are all companies that I use. If there's something that I don't like or we don't think it's appropriate, I don't use the stuff. But all the when I endorse it, it means that I've used it or I'm using it, or some instances like I don't wear bras, but that I've had it checked out by people who do. So if you're a member, love to hear from you guys. Maybe we'll put out a survey on that. And good time to become a member of the program if you can afford to. If you cannot, we're sending out a wave of responses to people who have requested free access to the show because they can't afford it. Maybe they've lost their job. We're doing that presently. That's how I'm going to spend part of my day off. And but if you are one of those people who can't afford to become a member, thinking about it today would be a good day to do it. Join themajorityreport.com. In the meantime, this is actually, I don't know, this has been a great experience for me, I can tell you that. And it seems even more meaningful now in some respects. But very difficult for families that are separated, particularly with parents and elderly members of families. There's many ways to stay in touch with them, but this is really fantastic. StoryWorth allows you to connect with loved ones everywhere, and you learn family history that you never knew about. I have learned a lot of stuff from this, and it is I'm not one of the people in my family who, you know, asks a lot of questions of other family members, because generally I just want to, you know, get out of that situation quickly. But I've learned a lot about this. That's what I love about this in many respects. What it is every week StoryWorth emails your family member. I suppose it could be friends too. Important people in your life. That prompts different story prompts. So they'll ask them questions that you never thought of to ask. Like, you know, what are some of your life's greatest surprises? What are the riskiest things you've ever done? What was your, I don't know, third job? It's just stuff to prompt the memory and get people writing about it. It's basically like if you had someone to remind you every day to go back in history and rewrite your journals that you never did. And then you get the stories on a weekly basis. And then after 1 year, what StoryWorth does is they compile every answered question and a photo you choose to include into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped to you for free. So you get it bound after a year. Right now, connect with family and discover untold stories with StoryWorth. Get started right away with the need for shipping by going to by going to StoryWorth.com/majority. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/majority for $10 off. That link will be in the podcast description and the YouTube description today. The Majority Report also is made possible in part by Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport7. And folks, I don't know that we have many of these slots left, to be honest with you. I did not check on this. So get on it. skl.sh/majorityreport7. You're going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 entire months. Skillshare is an online learning community, offers thousands of classes on almost any topic you can imagine. All classes are taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing. They have classes on painting, on photography, on video editing, web design, running a small business, a whole lot more. Also, I will tell you from my own personal experience, they have about 1 million, maybe this is an exaggeration, classes on playing the ukulele. We got a ukulele here. It's not a great one, but they have ukulele classes for kids. They have ukulele classes for adults. I'm doing the kid one, ostensibly because I'm trying to teach Saul, but I'm also not terribly musically inclined. But I am learning Old MacDonald on the ukulele All the classes are less than an hour long. Every class is split up into like bite-sized chapters. So if you need to do like, I can do two or three, like, I'm going to learn how to play C, and I'm going to learn how to play G, and then I'm going to learn how to strum. And then the next one is like, here, I'm going to play Old MacDonald. It's with literally just one note, but it's, look, I'm not musically inclined. But it's been great. It really, it's been great. And Saul is getting into it a little bit. Milo wants nothing to do with me, although I'm trying to get her to do the haircut, learn how to give a haircut class, because I need a haircut. Everyone can benefit from learning a new skill or getting better with one that you're good at. They have it for all skill levels. Explore something new. Great time to do that. A membership to Skillshare is less than $10 a month, and it gives you access to their entire library of classes. But like I say, the first 500 people, and it's not, I know that we do not have 500 slots left. I don't know how many slots we have left. Who go to skl.sh/majorityreport7 are going to get a free membership for 2 whole months. If by chance we run out, send us an email at Majority Reporters, and I'll talk to them, but I don't know. I would go do this now. I put the link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, we have it in the podcast description. It's all there. All right, quick break. And do I have any music here? Well, maybe we'll let Matt put that in. Quick break, and when we come back, I'll be talking to Howard Bryant, senior writer, ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, author of Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program senior writer for ESPN.com, a contributor for Sports Weekend, a sports contributor for Weekend Edition on NPR, and author of Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Howard Bryant, welcome to the program.
No, thanks for having me.
The book is a series of essays that looks at race in the context of, in some experience, you know, your personal experience, some from the world of sports, others just more broadly in terms of like the way that we treat police in this country and so on. You look at the story of Tonya Roberts. Some of the book is Massachusetts-centric, which I appreciate. But let's start with just the idea of Full Dissidence. What is that concept, and how does it tie these essays together?
Well, the concept for me was, I think it was a recognition after so many different iterations of being told that things were getting better and that your country was going to represent you in a certain way if you did all the right things, where you sort of recognize that that's not the case, that where we are today, especially coming after the 2008 election, certainly after the 2016 election, certainly after all the places where we've been, whether we're talking about Ferguson or whether we're talking about wealth inequality or all these other things, it's that this feels like it's the idea of the American dream is getting away from us, or getting away from me. And there was no question in my mind that I sort of felt like that this was that 2016 was a tipping point. And I was talking mostly about Colin Kaepernick in 2016, when the great news story of the day was that he didn't vote in the 2016 election. And I just was on the air on ESPN, and I said that maybe he just went full dissident, and maybe he recognized that there was no point being involved in this system when it doesn't feel like it represents you. And we were really talking about the fact that maybe a lot of people have sort of felt something along those lines, and it manifests in a lot of different ways.
It's fascinating because, I mean, just coincidentally, and we're pre-recording this, but today on the live show, I interviewed a professor of political science at UC Irvine, who Davin Phoenix, who wrote a book called The Anger Gap. And it is about how, in particular, how Black Americans, how anger does not play in the same way to them as it does to white voters. And part of that is a function of what you've, you know, of what you've expressed about Kaepernick, which is this idea of, like, you know, fundamentally, Donald Trump does not represent, is not sui generis in terms of their experience of America, that he is, you know, that he is, following a long tradition of American politics, and the way that anger is expressed by African Americans is not necessarily electoral, because they don't have that necessarily that luxury, and they don't find that there's necessarily an outlet to redress that anger.
Well, not only is there not an outlet to redress that anger, but there's nothing happening to Black America that wasn't happening before. And that's one of the points that I was trying to make in this book. I remind my 15-year-old son quite often when he talks about all his school friends, you know, talking about Trump and repeating their parents and Trump this, Trump that. And then I talk to my own friends, and especially my white friends, who have treated this period like it's the apocalypse. And I remind them, who was the president during Ferguson? Who was the president during Eric Garner? Who was the president during Oscar Grant or Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima or all of these other, or Rodney King? So when you think about our experience, this isn't the apocalypse for us. It doesn't mean we don't care. It certainly doesn't mean that Black people have checked out, but it does mean that the experience of democracy, the idea of democracy, where, for me, the idea of full dissidence is the recognition that you've been getting punched in the face for a lot of years. But unlike what I see in my countrymen and sort of the counterpart here, we haven't gotten punched in the face for the first time. A lot of people here have been treating this moment as though it was the first. In fact, you're seeing it right now in the post-mortem coverage of Elizabeth Warren, which is somewhat surprising to me, but a lot of commentary has made it seem like women are recognizing that the world's not fair. And that what that says to me isn't that this is the first time necessarily that they've recognized it, but they have a belief that fairness is due them. And I don't think that is an outcome that I see as tenable or even something that you can look forward to. It constantly gets reminded to us whose country this is, and every time you start to see some form of any sort of perceived Black advancement, there is an enormous backlash.
What about that dynamic of that, you know, like the, that I'm curious of that when you, literally what you've just described is what this political scientist found in terms of data and whatnot, is that notion of, like, you know, Black people just have not had that type of anger as it, within the context of the you know, electoral politics, because their sense is like the expectations aren't there necessarily. Like, what does seeing that sense of, like, wow, that's quite a luxury that you have, that you feel like you've been cheated, or that you've been somehow, like, that there's an unfairness, like.
Yeah, it produces an eye roll, no question. And it's not just an eye roll. It is, in some ways, there's a bit of envy that you can have that luxury of feeling like there's something here for you. And one of the elements of this book for me was, as long as I've been alive, the American attitude toward us has always been, from Black and white Americans and everybody in between, we're not perfect. We're getting there. There was an aspirational element to America. There's always been that aspirational element to America, that if you come here, you will have a great life if you try to have a great life. And that great life should be exceeded by your children, and then their children will exceed them. There was an aspirational quality to all of this. That's not what I feel today. What I feel today, especially in the American flag, is that the American flag is something, it's a concept to be obeyed, it's a symbol to be obeyed. It's not aspirational. It is love it or leave it, which is a term we've heard before, but it's certainly post 9/11 and certainly post Trump very much feels like it symbolizes a reclaiming. And so one of the questions in the book for African Americans and for all citizens is, what do you do with that reclaiming? How do you treat this reclaiming? And for African Americans, that reclaiming certainly comes from from a flag standpoint, certainly from a policing standpoint, certainly from the standpoint of having a say in this. So often when you even hear the president say things like, "Go, maybe you don't belong here," or "Love it or leave it," or "Go back where you came from." Well, we're from here, aren't we? Don't we have a piece of this? But also for white citizens as well, as they're finding out when you're looking at concepts of wealth inequality and oligarchy and all these other concepts that we're talking about, as money and celebrity distances itself from average people, and as labor becomes more and more and more suppressed, what does this mean for how you view this country?
And we should, and just to be clear, that reclamation you're talking about is the reassertion, which is not to imply that it went away, but a sort of more vigorous reassertion of white supremacy.
Well, absolutely, the mainstreaming of it. I mean, that when for as long as I can remember, you couldn't use these words, you couldn't speak in these terms. It was an automatic disqualifier to talk about white nationalism. It wasn't part of the country's aspiration. It wasn't part of the country's. It wasn't part of the country's future. At least it wasn't. It wasn't expected or treated to be part of a mainstreaming. Today, it is completely mainstreamed. It is a part of the government. It's embedded in the government. It's embedded in media. It's embedded in coverage. It's embedded in police. When you look at some of the even the FBI, the FBI studies and research show that there's an element of white supremacy embedded in our police, and nobody cares. And it's not an outrage to people, and they just sort of roll their eyes and you know shake their head that Richard Spencer exists or that Stephen Miller exists, and it's not that big a deal. And that says a lot to me, and that is chilling to me in some ways. But in other ways, it reminds me of this reclaiming that we're talking about. This is precisely where we've been headed. It explains the election, and it certainly explains as a reaction to the first black president. It's pretty obvious, and that's the reason why I don't think you see the anger. Where I do see something, Sam, that I do think is really sort of interesting, is I do fear for the younger generation of African Americans. Especially the really well educated, and who weeps for the Ivy League, but still,
right.
the ones who maybe 2008 might have been their first election, and then they see this as a reaction. For the older generation, like myself and my parents and my grandparents, they wouldn't have been shocked, because you can go historically and you see the backlash whenever something happens for black people in terms of progress. But for that generation, how many times have they been told about being colorblind? And how many times have they been told post-2008 about post-racialism and that the Obama election was supposed to create this new thing, and instead it's created more retrenchment?
I mean, it's funny that you say that, and I promised the last time I'll bring up this book, but that was the data shows.
No, I thought we were talking about my book.
No, well, I know, but also, but this, you know, this is, I mean, your book, obviously, but the data shows that apparently under the age of 29, black people express their anger through electoral politics, and it is not a, and that is this cohort of under 29s, not in the past, and that what you're expressing is exactly what the data shows, that there is a different perspective, and that on some level their expectation of what they deserved was is higher in some fashion, that is actually having them react with anger. And we're seeing that divide in the 2020,
Well, I can tell you, Sam, during this campaign and during the primaries, but during the debates, several of my African-American friends and one of my best friends, if not my best friend, has said to me often, during the summer especially, maybe this is the one we should sit out. Maybe, because we've done our part. We've done everything that's been asked of us. You asked us to come out and vote. Democratic Party can't exist without the black vote, right? We've done what you've told us to do. We've done all the things that we were told we needed to do to be citizens. And yet, electorally, the Democratic Party only comes around every 4 years, and our votes are supposed to be tallied, but we're not supposed to ask for anything in return for them. And what would happen if we just said, hey, you know what, we've already been here before. You guys are the ones who are talking about this apocalyptically. We're not. We've been here. We have already lived under the idea of democracy while Jim Crow existed and while slavery existed and while all this inequality has existed. And I would say, and I said to him, are you serious? Are you really talking about not voting in 2020? He's like, well, how bad could it get? You know, maybe now, if the Democratic Party got completely annihilated because black people stayed home, maybe now they'd finally listen to us and pay a little bit more attention to us. And it's interesting to me that you actually saw the reverse happen in South Carolina, and it's actually turned the tide for Joe Biden.
Right.
That you saw that black people instead decided to retrench and say, no, we have a stake in this. We worked too hard for our vote. We worked too hard to get this vote. And we're going with what we know, and we're not experimenting. We don't have the luxury to experiment. And we're going to stay solid blue. And we're going to show up, because if you look at turnout, how many times did African Americans get blamed for low turnout? The turnout's been good. So once again, you see how serious black people take the democracy. And at the same time, privately, you see the frustration that, are you getting a commensurate amount of democracy for your commitment? And the answer is clearly no.
Let's talk a little bit about Kaepernick and this concept of power and how his story essentially, you're a sports writer, and so you've seen this dynamic, and maybe just, you know, the whole Kaepernick thing made, you know, sort of crystallize some things for you on some level. But how Kaepernick sort of exposed the fact that that black people needed to subjugate themselves, that even with the amassing or theoretical amassing of power, it came at that illusion of power came with the subjugation of really the exercise of power.
No question. And I think that it's one of the reasons, that exercise is one of the reasons for this book. When I was finishing my last book, The Heritage, I was really talking about this return of the athlete activist and the return of the athlete exercising their power, whether it was LeBron James or Colin Kaepernick or whomever. And then I also began, after that book came out, I began asking a secondary question, which is, how much power do you actually have if you're not allowed to speak? Do you really have power if, by speaking and advocating for a position, you risk losing your livelihood, losing your career, losing your standing, losing everything? And what I began to think about, which is really how this book began to germinate, was we have... what you're talking about in terms of the illusion of power and the amassing of power is not the amassing of power, it's the amassing of money. What these players have a lot of is money. What they don't necessarily have a lot of is power. And that first essay, What Colin Kaepernick Taught Us, to me is an example of that. And it was an example to me also of my own mind needing to change. I think I was wrong on Colin Kaepernick. I was from the standpoint that I had enormous amount of support for him, and in my writing, I certainly supported him as a columnist. There's no question about that. But as he went on those first couple of years without giving interviews, without speaking, while really aligning himself and sort of his social media presence seemed to be more celebrity-based, even though he was doing phenomenal work in the community still, there were still grassroots activists, black grassroots activists, who were asking why he wasn't leading more. They were asking the question, how come he hasn't given an interview? How come he hasn't led the way? And so there was a fear on my part that he had sort of, you know, please don't go Hollywood, please don't go your own way, whereas I don't believe that everybody needs a beacon or a guiding light. Some people really did. But then something else happened, and that was when Nike came back with his commercial back in 2019. And, you know, I began to think about this, and the reaction, especially the white reaction, the law enforcement reaction in so many ways, was so hostile. Simply because this man had a commercial. He didn't get his job back. He wasn't in the NFL. All he did was voice over a 45-second commercial. And you saw law enforcement trying to boycott Nike. You saw some retailers boycotting Nike. You saw an enormous backlash to a simple commercial. And what that told me was that Colin Kaepernick needed more respect and more support, because there was a truly hostile reaction to this man, and it began making me ask a question. Why was it so important to completely annihilate this man? It's bad enough he didn't have his career. Why was it so important to completely annihilate? This is Paul Robeson level, to completely destroy everything about him, his ability to even earn a penny. And that told me that he needed more support. And it also said a lot about where we were in this country, that this was accepted.
And the idea being that you can't allow a black man who has a platform to express this much dissidence with America and not be completely destroyed, because you're sending the wrong message presumably to the rest of black people, I guess, and whatnot.
No question. No question. And I feel like there was that, and it made me think about sports in general, and it told me that there is an enormous level of anti-blackness in sports, that this is that trade-off that you were talking about earlier, that you get the money, and here's what we expect from you. We expect you to subjugate, that there's a price to this. And if you had real power, there's no price. If you have real power, you get to take yourself with you. You get to take all of you with you in the journey that you go when you go forward. And what I saw during this, especially in the reaction to Kaepernick, was, and the black reaction to Kaepernick from a lot of the athletes too, was this idea once more that something is being asked of you, and it goes beyond sports. It goes to sort of black aspiration and black ascension, and whether you're an upper middle class, you know, whether you're an upper middle class doctor, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a journalist or whatever, that there's a certain deal that you're making, and I began talking about that in one of the chapters, one of the essays called "The Worst Thing in the World," where I discuss this idea of the more I have climbed in my career, usually it's been the further you've been pulled away from blackness. The better schools are when you get away from the black community. The better neighborhoods are when you get away from the black community. The more opportunity is when you don't talk about or advocate for black people. So the more you distance yourself from black ideas, from the black community, from the black concept, the better off you'll be. And we see it with athletes, whether it's Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan or whomever, that impulse is there. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the players engage in it, but it does mean that they're being asked to do this, that there is enormous pressure there.
I mean, how much of Barack Obama was that? You know, I mean, I'm thinking about Randall Kennedy had a book in 2011 called The Persistence of the Color Line, which the argument was that he had to sort of like not be terribly assertive, not be seen as angry, you know, keep arm's length away from his blackness or any relationship that he would have to the black community to sort of like satisfy. I mean, this is the president of the United States, right? I mean, presumably the most powerful man in the world. I mean, certainly Donald Trump has not had to step away from his whiteness in any fashion. There doesn't seem to be anything that he's stepped away from in any fashion whatsoever, frankly. But Barack Obama is constrained in that way.
Well, no question. And I feel like the great moment of all of this is the Henry Louis Gates story, where, you know, Gates gets arrested trying to go into his own house because he'd forgotten his keys. He's trying to break into his own house. And a average, everyday, random, run-of-the-mill beat cop gets a sit-down with the President of the United States.
Right, right.
Do you know how absolutely, objectively ridiculous that sounds? That this would never happen in any other instance. In any other, I can't even think of any other instance where the President of the United States would sit down with a rank-and-file employee who was actually in the wrong.
Right.
But to me, that was part of this reclaiming. It was a reminder that this president was not just a president, that this president had to be reminded that he was black first, and that there were certain concessions he had to make to white America to assure them, even though he's the most powerful man in the world, supposedly, he had to sit down and have a beer with this man. Any other president, Trump, Clinton, Nixon, Washington, would have laughed at it. But this became a story. And the fact that, and there's a part of me that understood what Barack Obama was doing, but I also felt that there was a moment where Barack Obama should have said, I'm the President of the United States. And this conversation's over. Of course I'm not going to sit with you. Maybe somebody else from, maybe you'd have some state delegate or envoy or someone go speak to the Cambridge Police Department.
Right.
But how on earth did that beer summit ever take place? And how did anybody cover that with a straight face?
I mean, how much do you think, and maybe this is off topic a little bit, but how much was that, like, did Obama have that moment where he's like, I'm the President of the United States, I can't believe I have to do this, but I'm going to do it because it's performative? And or how much was it like,
never had to do it,
or was he the President of the United States because it was not his first thought to do that? I mean, is that why he could become the President of the United States? Because it had already been filtered out. He was that type of person who had that type of, like, my first reaction is, I should sit down with that cop. I can do, like, not indignation.
Yeah, and that's one of the big issues that I've always had with this, is this idea of, I always feared for President Obama for this very reason, this idea of being the racial bridge. And I always feared for him because I believe that he believed it.
Right.
And I believed that the opposition always used it against him, that he underestimated the deep opposition that he had, whether it was from the white people who were upset about him being president to the Republicans who pretty much openly said, our job is to make you a one-term president, that he believed that he somehow had the special sauce that allowed him to reach across the aisle. And it is and knowing his background and reading his history, it makes perfect sense that he would feel that way. We see it all the time. And, where I grew up and around those special, exceptional, high-achieving black kids who had to survive the white world. And they have huge numbers of white friends. They're somewhat detached from the black community because they live in white spaces. And they begin to believe that because all their white friends tell them, oh, I don't see color when I look at you. And they
right.
start to believe that they live in this. They believe they're not really what they are. And then they get reminded. And we all got reminded after 2008. To this day, in the 12 years since, we all got reminded about all that ridiculous post-racial fantasy talk. And you see now the retrenchment, and you see what has happened since. And it's never really been discussed enough to my satisfaction, but certainly I always worried about that because we've seen it at a smaller scale. And then something happens where the black man is reminded what you are here, and you're reminded very, very harshly, and everybody is scrambling to tell you it isn't what it is. Except you know the difference.
Do you think he ever had that moment? I mean, obviously there's a lot of speculation here, but he's becoming, he's extremely wealthy, extremely successful now in entertainment. He is, basically spending a lot of his time with, billionaires.
Yeah, but what does that all say? I mean, certainly, does it mean he got rich? Yeah, a lot of black people are rich in this country. There's a lot of rich people. Michael Jordan's rich. Oprah's rich. There's a lot of black people out there who have significant amounts of money. Where I think you should see it, if he doesn't see it, I feel very bad, but I'm sure he does, is the complete undoing of his monument.
Right.
Of anything that he tried to do as being dismantled right in front of him. And it's not being dismantled because it was done by a predecessor. It was done because he was the predecessor. And you can't ignore that. And if you're him, I certainly hope you see it. I certainly hope that maybe the attitude is, well, I did what I did, and I'm proud of my time, and now it's up to somebody else. I can't fight for everything all the time, which I understand. And he's got a next act. He's got a second chapter, a second act. I get that part. But I certainly doubt that you, if you're Barack Obama or any person in this country, you don't look at this and see the dismantling that's taken place specifically to the things that he did. And with a fair amount of vitriol, whether you're talking about, you know, Merrick Garland in the Supreme Court to right. virtually every Obama-era regulation that is being that's been undone. So you can't tell me that's not at some level personal.
I would think. I wonder if it is. I mean, I wonder. I mean, I guess I just, you know, I wonder like where, how does that manifest itself? He's still exercising, I think, a significant control over just this race. You know, I think he intervened behind the scenes with Buttigieg and Klobuchar. You know, obviously.
He's a titanic figure. I mean, he is one of the most significant figures this country has ever produced, which is a hell of a sentence.
Right.
So it's not like he's powerless. At the same time, there is extreme hostility happening, and that's one of the points when you're talking about some of the positives or the assets that he has. That's also what this book is all about as well. When you look at the second half of the book, the essay is about celebrity and about power and about how much celebrity, you know, how much dispensation we give celebrity. And where did Barack Obama go? He went straight to Hollywood.
Yep.
So you start to look at that celebrity is overpowering policy. Celebrity is overpowering reality in a lot of ways. Celebrity is overpowering politics in a lot of ways in terms of who now gets to be president. And remember, after the 2016 election, who were people talking about as a next possible candidate?
Oprah
and Mark
right.
Cuban.
Right.
Exactly. So here we go. And so you start to see that taking place, and you begin to ask yourself, especially for me, in that essay called The Hero Game, it is really all about the power of celebrity and how celebrity in a lot of ways is replacing policy, with Beyonce and Jay-Z and Kevin Durant paying for your college, or, you know, or
right.
Robert Smith buying
right.
your college, or trying to, you know, to have that. You can have this conversation, but you can't actually talk about debt forgiveness. And it's a really interesting place that we're in right now, where we're looking to LeBron James to save us, or you're looking to Bono to save us, and it just doesn't and shouldn't work that way.
Right. And I think there was some of that with Bloomberg on some level, but
100%. Billionaire is going to beat your billionaire
right.
that we've there. It feels it's certain. And that's when you're asking me, you know, what does full dissidence mean? That's what I mean about how where we are today in some ways feels like surrender. I'm not sure that people truly, truly, truly believe that Michael Bloomberg was the proper candidate. But I do believe they felt like, you know, we don't have the right weapon. He's got the weapon, which is money. He's got the money to compete with the guy who's currently there because he got there because of his money and his visibility and his celebrity. And if that's what we're doing now, if we're playing sort of celebrity roulette, then we need somebody, a policy wonk can't beat this current guy. So we need something else. And so it really does feel like surrender. It's been interesting to see how much his campaign just absolutely imploded. But the reason it imploded wasn't because he was rich. The reason he imploded is because he was a bad candidate.
Right, exactly. You know, like the idea of like a marginally bad candidate with that kind of money scares me, because like this guy was almost like uniquely bad, and that he could crumble like that. But I think the danger is still there. I think we might like to tell ourselves a story like his money didn't mean anything. Well, I don't know.
His
he
money
got
meant
on
a
that.
Lot. I just came back from spring training. I was gone for 9 days. I come home, and there's 14 Michael Bloomberg flyers in my mailbox.
Yeah.
And so believe me, had he been a better candidate, we're talking about a very different race.
Yes. Had he been a bad candidate instead of like an extraordinarily bad candidate, it might have been a totally different story. All right. Well, I've held you for a long time, but I really want to ask you about this. I'm curious because you tell the story of growing up in Dorchester, and at one point your parents making the decision when you were involved in busing to move to a suburban,
rural,
I guess, down in Plymouth at that
back
time,
then.
Which is on the South Shore. It's en route to the Cape Cod, and you became isolated and alienated from the black community back in Dorchester. How much of this experience do you think it, you know, and the way that you entered into that experience, I guess, helps develop your perspective in this way?
Well, it's enormous, because what ends up happening is that you see this is the current. You get tossed into the river, and the current is taking you where? Away from your people. Away from your community, essentially you're being told at every turn, and your parents are being told, that you have no chance if you stay here. You're at a disadvantage if you stay here, and it may be a fatal one, both in terms of your prospects and maybe physically, because of the level of violence in that community. And so when I talked about an anti-blackness in sports, it's an anti-blackness in everything, where you're being told that the only chance that you have is to move to a community where you're in a predominantly white setting. The only issue was that predominantly white setting didn't want you. So you were essentially trading one set of physical violence for the emotional violence of being the only black kid in class. But in another way, it's actually completely aspirational. The white families who were leaving Boston because they didn't want to deal with busing, because they wanted a better life for their kids, they were moving for the same reason we were moving. And what was really interesting and explosive when we got down there was that they thought they were getting away from us and then had to deal with our family as a neighbor. And so it was sort of, you could feel sort of those levels of hostility at that time. What was also sort of interesting about it, too, was the message that was being sent to you as a child. That, and it was a message that would follow as an adult, that you are doing the right, all of this is for education. That education is something that is not deserved of black communities. That if you really want to aspire, you have to make that decision to separate. Your parents have to make that decision to separate. And that is an extremely powerful concept. It still exists to this day. It's reinforced more now than ever when you look at the statistics of, especially in New York City, it's happening right now. If you look at Beacon and some of those big, the elite high schools, they're completely segregated in a city like New York. So the message is being sent to black children everywhere that where you are is not going to be good enough unless you go to be around white people. However, last point of this, is the statistics also show that if enough of you move to those white communities, the white people are going to move out. So it's this constant dance between, is it integration or is it assimilation? A few of you get to make it, but the game is still the same. If you want an individual chance, you have to sacrifice the group.
Well, the book is full dissidence. It is a series of essays. It's fascinating stuff, and particularly, obviously, in this era we're living in is, it's of that era. It is Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Howard Bryant, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Sam. This was great.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview I did with Howard Bryant. Really, I was thrilled by it, and I can't encourage you enough to go pick up Full Dissidence. He's a great writer. Not someone I was really terribly familiar with, to be honest with you. And really, really happy to have that opportunity. Folks, that's going to be our show for today. We'll be back live tomorrow. We'll take phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. They'll be here Friday, and et cetera, et cetera. Check it out. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. Become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, sign up for the AM Quickie. Check it out, ladies and gentlemen. 6-7 minutes every morning. Get the headlines of the day. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I am drinking an extraordinary amount of coffee these days, and it's all the Majority Report blend. I get a 5-pound bag. Also, don't forget, check out TMBS. They did a show last night. I don't know what, I don't have the details in front of me, but you can find it at patreon.com/TMBS or the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Also, Nomiki Konst. You can find the Nomiki Show on Patreon, patreon.com/TheNomikiShow, and Nomiki Konst on YouTube. Support these programs, folks. Check them out. Enjoy them. You know, this is going to be a tough time for everybody. Also, the Antifada. You can find that at patreon.com/TheAntifada. Jamie's on this week's episode. She was adamant about. Also, of course, Matt, Literary Hangover. Check that out. He's doing live Twitch streams and talking about, I can't remember what it is that he said that he was talking about, but, well, Matt, maybe you'll remind us. But check that out, Literary Hangover, also that the Twitch stream. We will see you tomorrow. To get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get.